worshiped your way. And I pray that you'd help us this morning as we dig in, that we'd be encouraged with who you are and your own holiness reflected through even the garments that the priests wore in Israel. Thank you for our time together. We ask this in your name. Amen. All right. We are in Exodus chapter 28-ish. Actually, we're at the last part of 27-20. And then we're going to work our way actually probably today. I'm thinking we may actually get through chapter 29 today. Because what we're talking about now, we move away from furniture in the tabernacle, and we're moving to the actual priests and the priesthood. This is the first time that priesthood is introduced to Israel. It hadn't existed previous to this, prior to this, and so this section is really the first introduction to the priesthood. So far, the Levites have not been set apart as the priestly tribe, if you will. That's going to happen. But right now we have the priests introduced and established, really with Aaron and his four sons. The first listing of the priests are Aaron and his four sons. And so I'm going to just start reading 27:20, and then we'll move through there. We talked a little bit about this last time. You shall command the people of Israel that they bring to you pure beaten olive oil for the light, that a lamp may regularly be set up to burn in the tent of meeting outside the veil that is burned for the testimony. Aaron and his son shall tend it from evening to morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever to be observed throughout their generations by the people of Israel. So again, we have introduced, it's Aaron and his sons who will be tending this lampstand in the holy place. So they're being set apart. And then from there we step into the actual priesthood itself. And so that starts at chapter 28, verse 1. And really if you're following along on the notes, this is letter Roman numeral 6, at the bottom of the first page of notes that you have, and it's the priests, 27:20 through 29:46. And first we have mentioned is the priesthood. It says, "Then bring near to you Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the people of Israel to serve me as priests, Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar." So those are the five that are chosen to be the first priests. It's interesting to me, what I find very interesting here is while this is going on, while God is choosing Aaron and his sons to be the priests for Israel, to represent them before God, at this time, what Moses doesn't know is going on at the foot of the mountain. Aaron is representing the people before a god, and it is a golden calf. So I find it very interesting that if you look at those two things beside each other, and I don't think it's an accident. I think it's important that God even chooses failed people or fallen people to accomplish this stuff so that we recognize it's not the priest himself that accomplished any kind of righteousness for the people. It was God who affected the righteousness and affected the sacrificial system, not the man. In fact, Nadab and Abihu aren't going to be around long. By Numbers chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu are going to be gone off the scene. They're going to be dead because they offer strange fire and are consumed by God. So that starts a long line of priests and high priests and that aren't very faithful to their mission and to their job. And again, I think it's important that points to not the man himself, but to God's design for the priesthood is what's important. So those are the five that are first chosen are Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And then he asks, then God says, and you're going to make holy garments for Aaron, your brother. So the first set of garments we're going to look at, that's the letter B, are the garments. The first set of garments we look at are the high priest. He's the only one who wore all of this. All the priests wore a special kind of garment, but the high priest was separated from them because he had extra stuff. He had extra things that he wore. And so we're going to be spending this morning looking at the high priest's garment. What I should have had done is I should have had Warren dress up as Aaron again and have him stand up here and so we could actually look at the things that he would be wearing. But there are specific pieces of clothing that he was supposed to wear. They are laid out in verse 4 of chapter 28. These are the garments they shall make: a breastplate, a breastpiece, an ephod, a robe, a coat of checkerwork, a turban, and a sash. Those are specifically the garments they're making for Aaron. Everybody else wore, there was a linen garment, linen undergarments that they wore. They all wore a hat of some kind. So there was four pieces of clothing that all priests wore, but there are five pieces of clothing that only the high priest wore. And so we're going to be looking at those things that set him apart from everybody else. These pieces of furniture are not furniture. Now I'm going to call them furniture. Understand that if I call these things furniture now the rest of this class, I mean clothing, okay? But it's in my head, they're furniture now, and so that's what it's going to come out. These pieces of clothing are designed to set Aaron apart, and in verse 2 it says, for glory and for beauty. Literally, that's for dignity and honor. That's how those words literally are translated in Hebrew. They're set him apart for dignity and for honor. In other words, this position that he's going to be serving in is a position that's a dignified position and a position of honor, not because of who Aaron is, but because of the position that he serves in. He is to be set apart, and these clothes, these special clothes he's going to get, are going to be designed for that happen. And they are spectacular clothes. They're not just normal stuff that you just would stick on. These are really special clothes. As he goes through and starts to list those things, they are because of what they're made of. What they're made of is significant. They're made of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twined linen. So again, remember, we're talking about the linen they got from Egypt. Egyptian linen was far more fine than even any linen that we have today, like twice as tight in its weaving than our fine linen today. It was amazing linen, and it would last, because it was so tightly woven, it would last for years and years and years and years, which it was necessary for that to happen, because these were going to be worn daily and used over and over and over again. But the gold, blue, purple, and scarlet are all very significant colors and very important colors, representing the people to God, and really showing the beauty of the priesthood and the glory of the priesthood and the dignity of the priesthood and the honor of the high priesthood. So that's what these garments are for. And they are to be built by or made by not just some, you know, a quilting circle. That's not who is supposed to get together and make these garments for Aaron. They were supposed to be made by skillful craftsmen. We're going to get introduced later to the skillful craftsmen who were the designed and built to or chosen to build the tabernacle and to accomplish these things. But they are craftsmen who were specially equipped by God and his Spirit for this work that they were called to do. And I think that's important, because as we read through this, you kind of can get a mental picture of what it's supposed to look like. But as just reading through it, there are some things that it's kind of hard to get going on ahead. And what Moses didn't have was a catalog where he walked down and showed the craftsman, okay, build it like this. I want it to look like this. He didn't, you know, get that from God. He got a picture, and he tried putting that picture into words for us to understand. But it would have just been verbal communication from Moses to the craftsman. But I think the craftsman got it right first time, because he was specially equipped by God and his Spirit to accomplish that. Just like the craftsmen who are going to be building the Ark of the Covenant and going to be building the tabernacle posts and all those things, they're specially equipped by God, and the Spirit came alongside them to accomplish this task for this purpose, specially. And I think that's the kind of craftsmen they're even going to be used to build these garments. So I think that's significant, because the same kind of spiritual guidance that was in the building of the Ark of the Covenant, in the building of the Table of Showbread, the building of the Altar of Incense, all those special and unique pieces of furniture, the same kind of spiritual emphasis is placed even on the clothes that Aaron is going to wear. I think that attaches significance to these things and makes them very, very important to understand and to get a hold of and to understand why this is really important. So the first piece of clothing, I call it clothing, yay, that is mentioned is found in verse 6. They shall make an ephod of gold and blue and purple and scarlet yarns and of fine twined linen, skillfully worked. So the first piece is the ephod. Now, it was an outer coat that, or like a waistcoat. It's what the best description I read about it. It was like an outer waistcoat that draped over the shoulders, and then was held together by gold chains and those kinds of things. So it wasn't like a vest. It wasn't a sweater vest. But the best thing I could picture it would be like Art's sweater vest. It would be that kind of a thing, but it wouldn't be stuck together on the sides. It would be just draped over Art, which is a good thing I wasn't high priest because I don't look very good in sweater vests. No. So that's kind of, maybe that's where we get sweater vests from. No, I'm joking. So that's kind of the ephod itself. It was made of beautiful, beautiful material, gold, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn. So they took all those four colors of yarn and they then wove them together with the linen to make this beautiful ephod. And it's amazing. It seems to me, if you understand the ephod, you really didn't see much of it. You didn't see much of the ephod at all, although it was a beautiful thing. It was covered up by a breastpiece potentially covered by a tunic. I'm trying to figure out how that worked. But it was a beautiful piece of clothing that was there. It had two shoulder pieces attached to two edges so that it may be joined together. So again, it wasn't hooked together by sewing it together. It was hooked together by these shoulder pieces that was attached on shoulder pieces. And the shoulder pieces were even special because on the shoulder pieces, they were to take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel. So on the shoulder pieces, there are these two onyx stones. Josephus calls it sardonyx, which was the best kind of onyx there was. In fact, instead of being onyx, typically I think is black, sardonyx is more of a deep purple color. So even beyond just regular onyx, this is sardonyx, is what Josephus says. And so it was a deep purple colored stones on each one of his shoulders. On each one of his shoulders were listed the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. I'm guessing that because he says mentioned that Jacob's sons, the sons of Israel, it would have been the 12 actual sons of Israel, not Ephraim and Manasseh. That's a guess. Although, if you look at the setting up of the tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh do get a tribe, but that's because if you understand how the tribes are allocated around the temple, Levi is mixed in the bunch. And so Joseph is represented by two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were his sons, if you recall. So if you were to ask me which names are on the shoulder pieces, I'm saying they're the actual 12 sons of Jacob, because they are the actual sons of Israel. So that's what I think. So you have there's six on one side, six on the other. and it's even more significant because of how they're engraved. They're engraved in the order of their birth. So that would make it even more potentially the six. So this is just the ephod so far. And so around the stones, they're going to be enclosed with settings of gold filigree, and you set the stones on the shoulder pieces and it's supposed to be for the remembrance for the sons of Israel. And so every time Aaron would go before God representing the people, he would have the names of Israel on his shoulders, and he'd be carrying them before the name. And I think that is Aaron carrying the people for remembrance to before God. That's what this is designed for. There's going to be a breastpiece that comes later. And it's interesting, the breastpiece is not the breastpiece of remembrance. The breastpiece is the breastpiece of judgment. It's a different reason. And again, you're going to still have the names of the 12 tribes. but I believe it's for a completely different purpose on the breast piece than it is on the shoulder pieces. It's a totally different purpose. This is for remembrance. As Moses, as Aaron goes before God representing people, there's a remembrance of. So why does God need to remember the people? I think there are times, even in the wilderness wandering, where God is going to be really mad at Israel. And Moses is going to go before God and say, but you got to remember your covenant. You have to remember your covenant with your people. Your word matters. And I think that's part of what's going on here, is that continual remembrance of what God did and how God took Israel and did the things he did with them, for them, and made them into his people. And there's constantly, as the high priest goes before God, he's called to remember the people of Israel and his covenant with that people. So that's the ephod. Is there significance to the gold, blue, purple, and scarlet? I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's significance to gold, blue, purple, and scarlet. I'm confident those are significant colors. But if you read 25 commentators, you'll get 20 different answers as to what the significance of those colors are. What we don't have is in the text a statement that says blue because of royalty, or purple because of this. What we do know beyond any shadow of a doubt is that every one of these colors of thread was a very expensive color of thread to get a hold of. And there is extreme value in each one of those colors of thread. So again, what is the importance, the significance of this clothing for Aaron? It is so that he is set apart with dignity and honor. That's what this clothing is all about. Without any kind of a question of that, these clothing and these colors are designed so that Aaron can be set apart from the people with dignity and with honor. And so there is priciness associated with even the clothing that he's going to be wearing. Even the chains that hold everything together on the ephod, they're not just iron chains. They're not even just chains made of cloth. They're solid gold chains that are used to hold all this together. So there's just in Aaron's ephod alone, there is an abundant amount of money spent just to make Aaron's ephod. It's very expensive if you were to consider that. And it sets him apart as one with dignity and one with honor. So that's what that's about. So that is the ephod. Attached to the ephod is the breastplate, or the breast piece, I guess. Some translations call it breastplate. ESV calls it breast piece. The breast piece is the breast piece of judgment. Again, skilled work in the style of the ephod. So it is like the ephod. It's made with the same kind of skilled work. It is made of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, so it looks a lot like the ephod, but it is just a breast piece. It's a square that is folded up in half. And so the way I understand it is, it was a square that was folded in half with kind of, so it ended up making into some kind of a pouch. Right? So it's a pouch. This is important because there's going to be something really significant that goes inside the breast piece. Right? So it's made of all that same kind of, it's made of the same kind of fabric, same kind of weaving that the ephod is made of, but it, rather than being made to go over shoulder or something like that, it's just made as a square that is then doubled up into another square. And my understanding is, at least the reading I did, it was like a 9-inch square. That's how big it was, like a 9-inch square on the front of Aaron. On the outside of that breast piece are 12 precious stones, 12 precious stones sewn on that outside piece with golden thread. So sewn onto there in rows of three, four rows of three. On each of those stones was written a name of one of the tribes of Israel. So now Aaron has this doubly represented the tribes of Israel. He's got it represented on his shoulders and on his chest. He's got the 12 tribes represented. Again, the shoulders are for remembrance, and the breastpiece is for judgment. I think that's also important as Aaron goes, or who would ever be the high priest, but right now it's Aaron. As Aaron would go in to do what he did, really, and the high priest is the only one who ever did the Day of Atonement sacrifice. No other priest did that. It was only the high priest did that. So as he walked into, the very presence of God, as he's doing the work he's doing, what he's carrying on his shoulders as God looks down on him, as he's seeing, remembering the 12 tribes of Israel. What he's carrying on his heart as he approaches the mercy seat and offers the blood to cover the sins of the people, to atone for the sins of the people, he has on his heart then the 12 tribes, and judgment is represented there. So in between God and judging the people, what happens? The blood of the lamb is sprinkled, or the blood of the, actually it's a blood of a bull, is sprinkled on that mercy seat that represents God covering the people and not judging them through that. So I think there's I think there's imagery there in the breast piece and in on the shoulders. So in that's the breast piece. It is made and it is sewn to and attached to the ephod, so it can never come apart from the ephod. It's always a part of the ephod. It's sewn with blue thread, with blue cords. It's sewn to the ephod and held together there. So here are the four rows of stones, a row of sardis, topaz, carbuncle, shall be the first row. Second row, an emerald, a sapphire, a diamond. Third row, a jacinth, I'm not sure what that is, an agate, an amethyst. Fourth row, a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper, and they'll be set in gold filigree. 12 stones with 12 names, according to the names of the sons of Israel. And they'll be like signets, each engraved with his name for the 12 tribes. So there's this, the breast piece. 12 individual stones. Again, I did try to figure out, so is there significance for the name and the stone? For, you know, for instance, is Reuben, which it may, if we're going in birth order on the shoulders, it would make sense we're going in birth order on the breast piece. So, you know, it seemed to me that it would mean that Reuben then would have been Sardis. Is there a connection with Reuben and Sardis? I can't find one. I just couldn't find any good connection there as to why it is. Is there an importance and significance to it? Yes, there absolutely is. Why would I say yes, absolutely? Because God actually didn't say just put 12 stones on the thing and call it good. No, he said here's the order of the stones. This is the order you put them in. But he doesn't say why. He doesn't say why you put them in that order. So for us, you know, 3,500 years later, to stand back and try to attach some kind of significance to that order or that kind, I think all we're doing is guessing. And it would just be a guess. And oftentimes what you'll find is when you start guessing about stuff like that, you really get it wrong. So let's say this. There is significance because God is very specific in how he says which stone goes where. Very specific as far as that's concerned. But he doesn't tell us why he picks each one of those stones. It's very possible that the children of Israel understood exactly what the significance of the stones was. And that's why it's not talked about. It didn't need to be told to them what the significance was. So they understood it. But I would say absolutely there's some significance to that, but I don't know what it is. So this breast piece has these 12 stones on it. Look at verse 27. Make two rings of gold to attach them to the front and lower part of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod, and it seam above the skillful woven band of the ephod, and then they shall bind the breast piece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a lace of blue, so that it may lie on the skillfully woven band of the ephod, so that the breast piece shall not come loose from the ephod. So these things are there. They're hooked together. So Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel and the breastpiece of judgment on his heart when he goes into the holy place to bring them to regular remembrance before the Lord. And here's something that in verse 30. And in the breastpiece of judgment you shall put the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be on Aaron's heart when he goes before the Lord. What are the Urim and the Thummim? I wish I could tell you. I really do. The literal translation of Urim and Thummim is lights and perfections. So they are the lights and perfections that got stuck into the breastplate. Most common understanding is there's some kind of stones that likely one had Urim written on it, one had Thummim written on it, and they were used by the high priest. At least tradition says they were used by the high priest to, in some sense, determine God's will when there was a choice between two things. How that worked, I have no idea. We really don't know much about Urim and Thummim. We know they mean lights and perfections. We know that they were two things that were placed inside the breastpiece and carried with the high priest whenever he had that whole garment thing going on. But that's all we know about Urim and Thummim. That's all we know. There are some places where you just wish that we would have gotten some more information. And it's like, okay, God, why didn't you tell us this? Why didn't you say so we could know? And the answer is we didn't need to know. It's not important for us to know what they were. What we do know this is Israel knew what they were for. Israel knew the Urim and Thummim. How do we know Israel knew the Urim and Thummim? Because Moses doesn't describe what the Urim and Thummim were. If, for instance, I'm trying to think, let's say 400 years from now, when there's no such thing as a television, right? No such thing as a television. Or better yet, we can just do now. When I was growing up, thinking of TV, right? Thinking of TV, in the mail would come this thing called the TV guide, right? And for anybody back in the 1970s and 80s, if you were to talk about the TV guide, everybody would know what it meant. So if I would say, hey, the TV guide, I wouldn't then say the TV guide, which was a book that explained what was going to be on TV for that whole month. You could go there and turn on, look at November 11th, and you could say, oh, November 11th on CBS at 7 o'clock is going to be, what Hawaii Five-O, right? Hawaii Five-O is going to be on then, back in those days. Book 'em, Dano. That's what was going to be on, those kinds of things, and you knew that. But I wouldn't, if I was writing a paper or writing something about that, I wouldn't have had to explain, well, the TV guide is this. Now, today, if you were to tell somebody about the TV guide, they're probably thinking, well, that's that thing on the, when you push the guide button on your TV, it tells you what's coming up next, and it's got all this stuff. Not exactly at all. It's totally different. So if I was to tell you today about the TV guide, if I was to tell the kids in the youth room about the TV guide, I would explain what it was, right? Because they would know. But when you're writing something or you're telling somebody about something they already know, you don't generally explain what it is. So that's why I'm confident that the people of Israel knew what the Urim and Thummim were and what they were used for, because God doesn't explain it to them. God doesn't say, and here's what you're going to use it for. He does that with new stuff, with stuff they don't understand. He does that with the altar of incense. He does that with the table of showbread. He does that with the altar itself and tells them how exactly to do sacrifice. He doesn't do that with the Urim and Thummim. He doesn't do it. So there had to have been some knowledge they had regarding what this Urim and Thummim were, or at least I'm saying there is, because he does not explain what they are. And this lack of explanation means that they, I believe, they had to have understood what they were. Otherwise, he would have explained it. There's going to be other things like that. For instance, there's going to be a time when we get through the Pentateuch, when Moses is going to remarry. And we don't know. There's great discussion. Well, did Zipporah die? Did Moses put Zipporah away? Why did Moses remarry? And frankly, his sister and Aaron and Miriam are really upset with him because she's a Canaanite woman that he marries. You find the story. You go find the story and you figure it out. But there's no explanation as to what happened to Zipporah. Why is there no explanation of what happened to Zipporah? Because the people he's writing to knew what happened to Zipporah. And he had to explain that to them. This is Moses getting the people ready to enter the land. It's not Moses writing a history for Israel for us to have. So We have to understand that there are those kinds of things that are going to be written as if the reader already understood what was going on. I think this is one of those things. The reader already understood Urim and Thummim, so they're not clearly spelled out for us 3,500 years later, even though it would have been nice. It would have been nice to know what exactly is this Urim and Thummim stuff, but we don't know. What I can tell you for sure, there's something that went into the breastpiece that meant lights and perfections. That's what we know for sure. So there you have it. And they are also go in with Aaron and on his heart when he goes in before the Lord. Thus, the last part of verse 30, thus Aaron shall bear the judgment of the people of Israel on his heart before the Lord regularly. So there is the ephod and the breastpiece. The next piece of clothing is the blue robe. The blue robe. And it's called the robe of the ephod of all blue. So this, here's my best guess is there's this robe, this all blue robe, and it said it came down to the knee or just below the knee, which if you remember when Warren's walking around like Aaron, his does come back down to about where it's supposed to come down to. So we actually got that somewhat accurate. And so it was there, and then you attach to the robe, then, is attached the ephod and the breastplate. So, I mean, it feels like Aaron is going to be a little, front heavy there because he's got this huge weighty thing on the front of him. So, but it's made of all blue, having an opening from the head in the middle of it with a woven binding around the opening like the opening of a garment. So it's got a seam around so that it won't tear as he puts it over his head. And then around its hem on the bottom, you make pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet yarns around its hem with bells of gold between them. So little pomegranates that were attached to the bottom of the robe and then interspersed between them were little bells. That would, of course, and if you've ever heard Warren as Aaron walking, you hear him jingling as he walks past you because there's a little jingle going on. and it's said here, it shall be on Aaron when he ministers, and its sound shall be heard when he goes into the holy place before the Lord, and when he comes out so that he does not die. I think that's a misunderstood statement right there that is hard to... Some have suggested, and this is a traditional thing, but I don't think it's found anywhere in history. There's a traditional thing that as the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, he would have attached to his leg a rope. And as he walked in to do his work in there, they would be the priests on the outside of the Holy of Holies in the holy place would be listening to hear the bells jingling. And if the bell stopped jingling, that means that the high priest went in unworthily and keeled over dead. And then they would have to pull him out because no other person could go in until there was a new high priest. Anybody that went in there that wasn't high priest would automatically die. So only the high priest could do that. And so they would have to, rather than go in and get him, they would have to bring him out or pull him out with the rope when the bell stopped jingling. Well, there are some issues with that. First of all, the high priest always went into the Holy of Holies the first time with sin because he hadn't sprinkled the blood for himself yet. The first time the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies, he always walked in with blood to sprinkle for himself first. So if it's the case, if he goes in with a problem and sin that's not covered, then he's going to keel over dead, then every high priest would have keeled over dead the first time they walked in. It would have been, you're done, because the first thing he had to do, read Hebrews, the first thing he had to do was walk in and first of all sprinkle blood for himself. Then he would come out. I think Ron said that he went in like five times that day. But the first time, right? Four times that day. But the first time he went in for himself. So if he goes in and he's going in for himself to offer atonement for himself and he can't do that without dying, it's never going to happen. That's my first problem with that whole deal. Second problem with that whole deal is how he got in. How he got into the Holy of Holies. It wasn't just pull a curtain back and walk through. There was a zigzag process. Hey, water. Thank you, Lori, for it. So he had to kind of zigzag between curtains. Because what couldn't happen is you pull back and expose the Holy of Holies to the holy place, making it not holy. So there was a zigzag process that went in. So if he's got this rope tied around his leg, zigzagging through there, he's getting all tangled up in curtains. Getting all tangled up in curtains. So that doesn't seem to make sense to me. So there is something about the bells related to death. Because Moses says, God tells Moses when he's building the robe for the high priest, he needs to have pomegranates and bells that so that they're jingling whenever he's serving and so that he doesn't die. But it's not, so in case he dies, it doesn't say that, in case he dies, it says so that he doesn't die. There's something about that jingling sound I think it's more like this. The bells announce the presence of the high priest coming in to the Lord, and only the high priest had bells on his garment. So it showed his worthiness to be in that place. I think that's what it's about. If someone walked into that place without bells on, they would die. They would die because they had no place to be there. Now, understanding there were guys who went in there regularly whenever the tabernacle was moving. You know, it wasn't the high priest that went in there and lifted all the furniture up. It was the Levites that went in there. But what happened when the tabernacle was supposed to move? God's presence moved first. God's presence moved out of the way first. That's how they knew they were supposed to move. When God's presence was over the mercy seat, they stayed where they were. It was when the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire moved away from that mercy seat, they knew it's time to start moving. So guess what? It wasn't the Holy of Holies anymore. It was a room that had furniture in it, and so then the Levites would go in, get all the stuff, and carry it to where they went the next time, set it all back up. As soon as they got it set back up, the presence of the glory of God would set back over that, and it would be established again. Yeah, Andrew. Yeah, okay, good. The question is, how did that work then during like Samuel's time? Well, what happened during Samuel's time when they stopped moving, okay? When they stopped moving, and I think this was a period of Judges as well, the tabernacle also stopped moving. The tabernacle was taken to a place called Shiloh and was set up there as the center for worship of God. And I think it stayed there. It stayed there. So if the tabernacle's staying there, there's no reason to go in and move it, right? If you read the history of, I think, if you read the history of the Jews, as they get into the land and they get established in the land, the tabernacle goes to a place called Shiloh, and there it stays until Abraham. No, Abraham. What is that guy's name? The king? David. Thank you. David, wow. David, when he buys the threshing floor from the Jebusites, and he establishes that mountain as where the temple is going to be built, then that is when it's moved there. But it is in one place. I believe if you track the history of the Jews and you track from Judges all the way to building of the temple, it stays in Shiloh. It stays in Shiloh and is not mobile. So I think they wouldn't have to move it. They wouldn't have to go in and move it. It wouldn't be taken apart. I don't think the tabernacle was taken apart for that period of time. I don't think it was moved. So that's how I would answer that question. I could be wrong. I could be wrong, but I will tell you this. Any time it had to be moved, there clearly the presence of God was not in that place. Because if it was, I'm confident that anybody going in there would be dead. Nadab and Abihu just offer strange fire, and they're consumed like that. So I believe that that's what I think the bells are for. I think the bells were to announce more for And does God know everything? Absolutely, he does. But I think there's significance in making sure that it was the one who was dignified and honorable, the one with dignity and honor, was the one approaching the Holy of Holies, was the one approaching the mercy seat, the one who had the right to have access into that place. That's what makes Hebrews chapter 4 so significant. There was only one person on one day of the year that when the presence of God was in that place, had access to that place. Anybody else who even attempted to approach that place would approach that place with fear and with trembling and with certain death approaching them. But because the veil has been ripped from top to bottom, because we have access to God, we no longer have to go into that place with fear and trembling. We can rather come boldly into that place as we are, as our own selves, not relying on a high priest who have gone in there before us, because a high priest already has gone in there for us. And his name was Jesus, and he sprinkled his blood once for all. And therefore, because he sprinkled his blood once for all, we have bold access to God, which is something that was really, really significant for the Jews. And it's really significant for us too. But I think in the mind of a Jew, they would have gotten that instantly, because they would never have considered themselves to have bold access to God and to his presence, to the very throne room before him. So that's how I answer that question. Long answer, short question. Go ahead, Ron. Excuse me. So, I don't know if you caught all that, but I'm not going to repeat it all. But it was really good stuff. If you want to hear what he said for sure, then get with him after the fact, which we're at 2 minutes. But there's not time to. So what we covered this morning was the ephod, the breastpiece, and the robe. There's one more major piece of clothing for the high priest, and that's his turban. We'll talk about that next week. And then we'll look at the clothing for all priests following that and move forward. So, I want to spend some time on the turban, because there's specifically one thing on there that's really, really important. It's a gold plate. So, we'll pick that up. We'll pick that up then next week. Again, I want to emphasize this. It's not the man who was important. The man fails. In fact, again, while God was choosing Aaron to be the high priest, he's down at the foot of the mountain making a golden calf. So, I mean, it's not about Aaron. It's about God. And it's about the work he intends to do and showing himself as the Holy One of Israel and it represented there. But in all of that, there is, I believe, as you look at the sardonyx stones on the shoulder and you look at the gemstones on the breastplate, I think that speaks to the value or how special God saw his choice of his people and how significant they were. He didn't see them as trash. He didn't see them as unimportant. He saw them as precious in his sight. In fact, he refers to Israel as the apple of his eye. which is they held a very special place in his heart, and still, I believe, still do. I don't think he's done with them yet. I think he's still working in and through and for them, and he's doing it right now through the church, which is causing them to become jealous and to someday return to him, as is prophesied in all of the prophets, prophesied return. So that's a quick summary. Let me pray, and then we'll let you get out maybe half a minute early. Lord, thank you for our time together this morning, and for your specificity in how you even wanted the high priest to wear clothing. Pray you'd help us to see your hand of perfection in all you do. We ask this in your name. Amen. You're dismissed. Thanks.